For as long as I can remember, I've found myself searching. Searching for meaning, for understanding, and trying to find the true essence of who I am. To make sense of all of the knowledge that's out there, and how I could use that to be the best version of myself. Physically, emotionally, spiritually, and professionally. Through my own experiences and conversations with inspiring people sharing their authentic stories, I've realized that the answers to some of life's most challenging problems often lie in very simple messages. So join me on a journey of discovery where I speak to real people with real stories sharing real insights. I'm Sanjeev, and you're listening to my podcast series, Just Another Lens. Welcome, James Frater.
Thank you.
To this podcast, Just Another Lens. I really appreciate you agreeing to do this because I know you said you've said no to people for the last 18 months.
Yeah.
So I feel privileged. But you've got an amazing journey story to tell. But before we go ahead, who is James Frater?
That's a good question. I think if I was to surmise who I am, I would say I'm a servant. Because everything I want to do in my life, everything that I have done and am doing is in service to other people. And that like servitude comes from my faith. So servant, because I believe that as a man of God, as someone who follows Christ, that is my kind of purpose on earth. The way I exercise that is obviously going to change throughout my life. But I think that's a good word that summarizes kind of who I am and who I kind of want to continue to be.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's something I can genuinely connect with. Mm-hmm. Similarly, on my spiritual path, I had a mentor guru who I've known from my youngest childhood. His life message to everybody, in the joy of others lies our own. Mm-hmm. In the progress of others rests our own. Service.
Yeah.
The joy in serving. Mm-hmm. James, you've got an amazing vision.
Yeah.
To transform the world.
Yeah.
Transform health. But before we go there, mm-hmm. I want us to go right the way back to your early childhood.
Yeah.
Because I know, as much as most people I speak to, that was a really important part in your journey. Mm-hmm. So take us back to that time.
Wow.
In Jamaica, right?
Yeah. So I was born in the UK, then very sort of young, I moved to Jamaica.
How old are you?
I'm not sure if I'm being completely honest. As you knew, I was really young, wasn't like cognizant of the move. My first memories are actually of Jamaica. So I typically start my story in Jamaica, Jamaica. And then I continue. So it's my mum that always reminds me, oh, by the way, you were born in England. I remember that part. So I'm going to start the story in Jamaica, but just because that's
sure.
Where I have the memories. And I think the memories that stand out for me, there are two. I think the first one is very happy, very full life in Jamaica as a child. Every day was different. Every day was exciting. You would kind of come back home from school, change out of your school clothes. And then there was like a yard to kind of go and play and explore and find new adventures. The other side of that was I had a lot of problems with my asthma.
You have asthma?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had asthma and it was really uncontrolled. So it meant that very often I was going to hospital. So I would say on average, every 6 weeks, I was in and out of hospital. And I think for the adults, it was stressful. For me, it was exciting.
Okay. Having to go into hospital, exciting. Okay. Note to self, reframe. Yeah.
because for me, I was four, right? Apart from actually being unwell, struggling to breathe, I think once I got through that, being in hospital became like a second home to me because I was there so frequently. And having to sort of develop a relationship with nurses, doctors, all the other healthcare professionals and auxiliary staff that were there, it just meant that I was coming back home, I was returning. Which is strange to kind of reflect on now, but I think as a child, I just saw it as this like big adventure. I didn't have to really think about the other parts around it, apart from getting better and seeing people that I knew and recognized and that recognized me. But as I grew up and as I started to reflect on those experiences, I recognized that I wouldn't have survived if it wasn't for the car that we had. If it wasn't for the fact that I could get to the hospital, which was an hour away from us. It was an hour drive, so you can imagine how far it is by public transport, or how long you'd have to wait. The fact that we could afford the medication, we could afford some of the equipment at home,
mm-hmm.
meant that I could survive long enough to get to hospital.
When did you have that first reflection like that? What kind of age were you?
If I'm honest, I don't think it was until maybe late teens, early 20s.
Okay.
When I started to think about all the other things around healthcare. Because I think growing up, I always viewed healthcare as the clinical intervention. So going to hospital, going to a GP, getting medication, that was healthcare for me. And so being able to fully understand what healthcare is and all the things that impact healthcare, I was then able to appreciate that all those social determinants of health, even the fact that my family could communicate what was happening with me and articulate and advocate for me, those things were all important. And not all families kind of do that.
Can I just stop you there? Yeah. Something that you just said.
Yeah.
I hadn't consciously thought about it, but I was sitting in front of a panel, government policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about challenges, sociological challenges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one thing that kind of I brought to the table was an understanding that there's a whole spectrum of people
mm-hmm.
in the wider community, in the UK, modern day UK,
mm-hmm.
who's the ability to communicate mm-hmm. with the authorities, with the mm-hmm. medical professionals, mm-hmm. are limited. So that immediately, from what you said, creates a barrier
absolutely.
To their wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. I was having a conversation earlier with someone who's in the NHS and is quite high up in the role that they're in. And we were just talking about housing, for example, how housing is linked to healthcare. And if you have a child with asthma in the UK, for example, and you're treating them in the hospital, sending them home to a place where there's high pollution, to a housing situation, has mold, overcrowded, full of dust, all these things. The clinical interventions might work for a week, but then they're going to come back. And actually, this child won't be healthy until they move or the housing increases. But there are so many barriers to that because, one, typically healthcare professionals don't interact as well as they should have, as they should with local authority. So then there isn't that communication about the health needs in terms of the housing. Then you might have a situation where the family might not be able to communicate their need to the local authorities because, one, it might be opaque. Two, English might not be their first language. Three, there's just so much need that they're at the back of the queue and everyone in front of them is also urgent. Or they might not. There might be like a fear of reaching out for help because they're in a situation where they feel that they're struggling. There might be some shame. So no one ever kind of seeks help. So there's so many challenges around advocating for yourself that I think more and more healthcare professionals are recognizing. I think particularly public health, which is I can talk a little bit more about. We recognize that there are so many things that affect health. And you can't just look at it through like a single lens. And I think I definitely appreciate that through my own story in Jamaica.
Okay, so let's go back to your story.
Yeah.
So you born in the UK mm-hmm. as a young child, went to Jamaica. Where's your journey take you from Jamaica and when?
Yeah.
So I believe you moved back to the UK.
Yeah. So the number of factors that kind of led to me moving back to the UK. One of them was my health because I was going to hospital so frequently. It was starting to become worrisome. As much as I was having fun, I think the sensible people around me realized that for the asthma to be so uncontrolled, there were also a few close kind of calls. And so moved back to the UK, which was a shock, to say the least.
Are you really this happy-go-lucky, by the way? You seem to be talking about these near-death experiences and health challenges. Fun. Is that your nature? Is that part of who you are?
I like to find joy in things, yes. I'm quite optimistic because I believe that everything happens for a reason. I think in that particular circumstance, it was just naivety. I was ignorant to kind of like, when I say ignorant, just innocence around how life-threatening this was. I was uncomfortable. Doctors treated me, and then it became like, oh, this is fun again. I just wanted to play. And so I think if it was now, I probably wouldn't have viewed it so positively just because I had more awareness. But I think at the time, I just didn't have that awareness.
So then that journey brought you to the UK because presumably the accessibility to healthcare in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
As a young Jamaican Caribbean boy coming into the UK, what kinds of challenges did you face and why do you think they were there?
So I think for me, as well as challenges, there was also some really good things about being a young Caribbean boy, particularly in the time I grew up in. So on the challenges side, I think a challenge existed before me. I would start with Windrush, although I don't think that's the start of the story in terms of the Caribbean community.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think it's an important marker in Black British history. And from that point, there was a lot of opposition and a lot of barriers, discrimination, racism that happened, particularly with that group.
How bad was it?
I don't know. Yeah, I wasn't there. So I
can't. Were your parents part of that experience?
Not Windrush, but definitely kind of. My dad came before my mum did, and so he could tell me a lot about sort of some of the physical violence that he might have experienced. But I think more than that, a lot of the Caribbean community, for example, in education, were excluded. So they were sent to educationally subnormal schools, where a lot of young Black boys in particular couldn't access mainstream education, and as a result, couldn't go on to university. And so you now have a legacy of that in our school systems, where particularly Caribbean boys are one of the worst performing groups in our education system. And that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world.
So let me understand that again. Did you just say that young Caribbean boys were sent to sub-standard schools or the lower performing schools deliberately?
So it was schools for people who had special needs. So like whether that's SEN or anything like that. SEN is, I can't remember what SEN is. It'll come back to me. They were sent to schools with students who needed extra help because of where they came from, maybe because of their accent, maybe because of like how they behave. They were seen as, oh, they can't go to like mainstream schools. So as a result, couldn't perform as well as other students. And then the ripple effect is that when you have parents who, one, don't trust the system, two, have had like terrible experiences of it, that then affects the way they can engage their children with the systems that exist. And then you still have this legacy today.
So something as simple as, I say simple, in modern day Britain, you'd think it'd be simple.
Yeah.
As somebody's accent, a child's accent, and perhaps the freedoms that they would be used to in their, wherever they're brought up originally, that deemed it necessary or normal or appropriate for the education system in Britain to assign them to special needs schools.
So I just want to clarify, I think that was only like one part of the reason. I think the overarching reason was racism, full stop.
Blunt. That's what I want to get to, right? Because ultimately, even that, where's it coming from me?
Yeah.
That's it. It's basically racism, right?
Yeah.
It's filtered with these narratives, with those descriptions, but it's racism.
Yeah.
And it's unacceptable.
Yeah. So as much as I kind of want to highlight that the reason I mentioned that is because that's what I came into in terms of a system that expected me not to do well. Fortunately, I did very well in school, and coming from Jamaica and the Caribbean in general, you're expected to do well in school. You're expected to take education seriously. I then came here, and my mum and like my family around me still kind of instilled those values. And I think fortunately, because I didn't start my schooling system here, I didn't have any idea that I wasn't supposed to do well. All right. And so I remember I would be at home. I would finish all my books from W.H. Smith, and then I'll get new books from higher years, etc. So I did quite well from when I started school academically. And so there was never a point where I felt where I was falling behind, or where, well, anyone had a chance to kind of tell me, oh, you can't do well, because I performed well from I started school here.
So you were able to bypass the narrative and the preconditioning, the expectation preconditioning, because you're already in an education system that expected you to do well, to work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people who are migrants from wherever they are can relate to that.
Yeah. But I also want to be clear, like, I think there's a particular effect on Caribbean boys, because no other group performs as badly as Caribbean boys outside of Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community. And I think white working class boys as well were kind of grouped in that. And so I definitely think a lot of policies specifically targeted that group. And the attainment figures are there for anyone to see. And so I almost feel quite fortunate not to have been aware of that. But I definitely felt the effects of that. I won't go into kind of too much detail around school because...
got through it. You basically managed to overcome whatever the limitations of the system were and get through school.
Yeah.
And but your awareness of the environment for other Caribbean people was very clear then. And that somewhere along the line started shaping part of your reason why.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
To make a difference. So tell us how that progressed. And who were the, were there any particular people in your journey from that time onwards who played a part in shaping who you are?
So before I even talk about that, I think the second part of coming to the UK as a Caribbean boy was that I was fortunate to be surrounded by a Caribbean community. And so I was still able to kind of celebrate my culture and feel celebrated because I had that ecosystem of other people. I had lots of family here, lots of cousins as well. And I also felt that as a Jamaican, a lot of our culture kind of shaped even language. A lot of slang comes from patois. And I definitely felt that growing up. And I was really kind of proud to be Jamaican, and I used to go back regularly. So there was definitely a lot of pride growing up in being Jamaican, and I saw lots of Jamaican culture in Britain.
For those who don't know, can you give us a couple of examples of the slang that you say?
So even like growing up, people would say wagwan when they're greeting each other. That's a Jamaican word. Or even like brethren, I would hear growing up, which is like brother, right? So there are different words that I had growing up that I resonate with, right? Because I knew they came from patois and from Jamaica. And so definitely had like a dual experience growing up.
So you felt you had this sense of community and belonging from the Afro-Caribbean community, the Caribbean community surrounding you. Mm-hmm. So you are surrounded by people who you could relate to, that you could celebrate your identity and be who you are and the joy of that.
Yep.
Despite being in an environment where, let's face it, the cards were stacked, not particularly favorably, but you managed to navigate all of that.
Yeah.
So two parts of that equation. So so that highlights the importance of community.
Absolutely.
To me.
Mm-hmm.
How important a part do you feel before we move on?
Yeah.
Is the need for a sense of belonging and the community being able to be who they are and celebrate who they are?
I think sense of belonging, communities is everything. I think community is the heart of all solutions that I kind of envision for the world. Sense of belonging also. But I think my caveat is that you can feel sense of belonging around people who don't necessarily share all your identifiers, right? I feel sense of belonging with you. And you're not a Jamaican man, right? And so I find that as I've gotten older, it's about finding ways to find sense of belonging or connecting with people, even if there are like, for you, you can't visibly see things that you might be able to connect with. I think when you sit down and share your story and connect people on a human level, there's definitely ways to feel sense of belonging and community with people that you might feel different from you.
And there's this phrase that's bandied about, unity and diversity, on celebrating diversity.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't understand this, meaning they've never had the sense of they're not part of a a community or, mm-hmm. you know, felt excluded even.
Yep.
What messages or lessons are you sharing, could you share about making them aware of it, mm-hmm. To look out for people who may feel like excluded or yep. different? And because you're speaking to policymakers as well, right? This is...
Hopefully.
you are. I know that your journey and you managed to open doors and knock on doors that people like me, mere humans go, am I allowed to do that? Are we yeah. are we able to do that? So what can you share about what it feels like for being, okay, we're not made to feel like we're part of the wider piece.
Yeah.
And what advice would you give to people
yeah.
to try and develop that?
So as I think about that question, the phrase that comes to me is like imposter syndrome, which I don't agree with, which is like a way to open. not because I don't think the theory kind of exists, but because I don't think imposter syndrome is the onus is on a person. I think that there are systems and environments that make people feel excluded, and the onus isn't on the individual to do better. Right, it's on the environment to become more inclusive. So even when I think about sort of advice for people, it's recognizing, number one, that sometimes environments are exclusionary, and not trying to think like, what did I do wrong? Like what difference in me has caused this to happen? And figuring out or realizing that actually the environment is a problem, first of all. I think fortunately, in the age of technology and just I think in the age of awareness, I think more and more communities of people who want to connect with people that are different exist. But I think at the same time, you see lots of division in society, which can make it feel like it's very difficult to find other people that you might not like directly kind of relate to, but maybe want to sort of explore. I was at an event yesterday where I met so many different types of people. And actually, it's figuring out ways to amplify those a little bit more, because I think the noise of division is so loud at the moment, in particular, especially with what's happened recently, that we need to figure out ways to kind of be like, yeah, I think amplify the people doing the good work to bring communities together.
I love that contrary perspective to this imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. As somebody who honestly does feel sometimes am I, whatever the definition of imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. you're absolutely right. The fact that somebody would feel that way, mm-hmm. to me, reflecting on what you said, has some responsibility or connotation to the people that you're surrounded by mm-hmm. to help you feel that you deserve, you belong. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably a combination of both. Mm-hmm. Personal responsibility, what can I do, what can we do?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also I understand the conditioning of the environment mm-hmm. that you're used to. Mm-hmm. You know, that presents itself in all sorts of forms.
Yeah.
We talk about, you know, women in leadership. Mm-hmm. We talk about the cultural diversity. Mm-hmm. We talk about people like me who haven't ticked the boxes on the educational path. I was nowhere near as bright as you academically. I just didn't figure it early on. Mm-hmm. But that had its own baggage and weight, trying to feel comfortable, be accepted mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in environments where certain things were the credentials mm-hmm. or the base of value.
Yep.
So that's a wonderful thing. And lastly on that, this thing about celebrating and making more visible all the great work that is happening
yep.
and the good people that are, I say good people, mm-hmm. I mean in terms of communities.
Yep, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
Because it is happening. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the media... I don't watch the news, by the way.
Yeah.
I made that decision a long time ago. I don't apologize for it. Mm-hmm. Because I think if you look back, history was about power of, you know, nations, leaders. I believe we're in the world of power of the media mm-hmm. and communication. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my advice consistently is like yours. People should meet as people. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how much we have in common and how much the values that connect with people and celebrating that together, that's wonderful. So mm-hmm. I know you're constantly looking for opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for that. And like I said, for me, you feel like we're all part of the same culture, community, might be differences, but there's much more in common.
Yeah.
So okay, what steps can families make to start to believe that things can be different.
Yeah.
What kinds of things do you do? Or do you encourage people to do? Because I know you do.
Yeah. I think it's difficult. So again, I always have like two answers to a question. I think the first thing is recognizing that for a lot of people that came before me, following a trodden path was necessary because lots of people are surviving. And I recognize that telling people do things differently or you can be whatever you want isn't always attainable for everyone. And I think it's a privilege to be able to actualize the dreams that I have. And I recognize that like, fully. I think at the same time, I recognize for my life, and this is something that you know, I believe in living audaciously. And that's living a life that you choose, not one that is given to you. And that looks different for different people. It can be quitting your 9-to-5. It doesn't have to be as kind of dramatic as that. I think for me, it's always like living in a way that is like true to who I am, rather than just looking at the options available to me and saying, oh, because I can do that, that's what I'm going to do. No, it's what do I want to do? And planning for that. But that's kind of how I organize my life. And I think people should aspire to, but I understand that not everyone can have access to that.
So living audaciously.
Mm-hmm.
I watch your TED talk
mm-hmm.
about this very subject.
Yeah.
For the listeners mm-hmm. of this podcast, it's got a wide listenership.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to be able to share this living audaciously, what that is.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people will relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people across generations, across cultures. So yeah. Talk me through.
Yeah, I'd love to. So for me, living audaciously has always, I think, always been on the bubbling inside of me as a way of living, a lifestyle that I think I resonate with deeply. But the spark for me was actually when my close friend, Shireen Watson, she passed away from terminal cancer. And she was diagnosed around like 23, 24 years old and passed away at, I think it was 26, a month after her 26th birthday. And so for me, it was a huge shift in what I believe the world to be, in that I had always imagined my life to be like 80 plus. I had so many decades to live. And I still believe that in sort of like theory and principle. But I also viewed life as periods of doing things because you have to in order to do the things that you want to. And I think after sort of going through an experience and after seeing that, I then realized that I had to live every part of my life intentionally. That doesn't always mean that every part of your life, you do everything that you want to in exactly the way you want to at the time that you want to do it. But it's always optimizing for that. Like, what does my life kind of look like? If it's going to be as purposeful as I want it to be, if it's going to be as close to the person I want to be, what kind of values do I want to live out all the time? And how do I make sure that the parts of my life get to as close to that as possible?
So the heart of that
mm-hmm.
is joy, right?
Yes. Service, I think, is the heart.
Service.
Yeah.
Okay. So but that's because you get your joy from service.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think I get my joy from God.
Even better, because yeah. that's the bigger picture that connects everybody, connects us all.
Mm-hmm.
So tuning into that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real power that people that when I speak to a faith, and it's kind of people of no faith, they must find meaning and purpose in something
mm-hmm.
and have their anchors. But
mm-hmm.
I think when you have that strength of faith and conviction,
mm-hmm.
it can be so powerful because you surrender to it.
Yeah.
And when you surrender to it, then the outcome is at a greater level to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
then down to that living true to that
yeah.
that meaning, that faith,
yeah.
And being congruent with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned this friend of yours who passed away mm-hmm. from terminal cancer at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
You were always driven from, you always knew you wanted to, based on your health challenges at a young age.
Yeah.
You had a big vision anyway to start off yeah. with.
Well, actually, no.
No?
It was big for my age.
Sorry, yes, contextually, big yeah. for your age.
So I think my initial vision was I wanted to be a doctor, which I guess is a big ambition. But I wanted to be a doctor so I could set up a clinic in my backyard. That was the height of my ambition.
In your backyard, meaning?
In Jamaica, I have a yard.
Right.
And I wanted to set up the clinic in it. Because for me, growing up, I didn't, as I said earlier, recognize the social determinants of health. I just saw that I went to the hospital, I got better, I enjoyed that experience. I knew that my friends might not be able to get to hospital, so I thought, let me set up a clinic in my backyard to help fix them. Yeah. And so I remember saying it all the time to my grandma at the time, who's looking after me. And I used to like wrap her up in bandages because I was practicing for when I got real patients. Wow. And that for me was like the height of my ambition at the time. So I guess actually for a 6-year-old or for a, sorry, a 4 or 5-year-old,
pretty big.
That was ambitious, right? To kind of think like that.
You're somebody who is, to me, who lives life to the full.
Try to.
Who's constantly, I mean, I remember sitting on that panel next to you.
Yeah.
And you were deeply thinking and engaged in the conversation and thinking about the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing canned about you. and so when you came up with this idea of living audaciously,
mm-hmm.
and I know it was after the tragic loss of a childhood friend.
Yep.
What do you think in the moment gave you that? Was that the feeling of loss and realizing that there's no guarantee of how long we have left on this mm-hmm. earth? So what was the start of, what do you believe was the inspiration for that living audaciously? And then where are you on that journey now?
Yeah. So, for me, living audaciously has always, I think, been in me, okay. as a principle. I think the passing of my friend was the spark that really unlocked it and gave me a sense of urgency around, formulating it as a principle, as an idea. And so I remember, I journaled once that I need to live a life that I choose and not one that was given to me. Then it was like, eureka, this is it. It was really kind of, it was one sentence, very neat, very nicely packaged. And I kept on repeating that to myself over and over again. And I'll talk about even the decision not to practice medicine was centered around living audaciously.
Rewind. How? You went to medical school.
Yes.
And you decided not to practice medicine.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, we'll pick up on that in a second.
Yes.
Carry on.
Yeah. And so, that was, I don't think it was necessarily centered in loss or like anguish. It was more hope. Hope for a life that I could live, a life that I thought other people could live, a life that my friend did live, right? It was, she lived audaciously all the time. If she wanted to try something, she would. If she wanted to go somewhere, she would. And so for me, it was really thinking about, what are my values? What are the things I really care about? Who do I want to be? What brings me joy? What kind of resources do I have? Like who am I? Where am I? Who do I want to be? And I think putting all those things together and mapping out a life that I thought I wanted to live was a cathartic experience. And I wanted to share that with the world, which is why I did the TEDx talk.
And it was a great talk.
Thank you.
We'll put a link up in the bio for that. But you, as you say, I mean, it's coming across in the conversation already.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly stretching and thinking and evolving.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to define you
in a
label or a description.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the joy of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
The openness to accept, this is my clarity of thinking here,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not locked in and wedded to it forever.
Yeah.
Because you evolve as the landscape and the experience and the mm-hmm. opportunities.
Yeah. And the need to serve, like where the need is. Right? I think although my overarching mission has stayed consistent, the way I exercise that evolves all the time because mm-hmm. you recognize that people's needs are nuanced and the way in which people needed to be served 10 years ago has shifted. And so actually I have to adapt. I have to gain skills. I have to be different in order to achieve the same kind of end goal that I had from all those years ago.
Which takes me back to that. Oh, and I decided not to do medicine.
Yes.
So I'm going to take it slightly during that journey of your med school because you went to, you as a youth were determined you're going to get into med school.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that journey. Based on, remember we talked about this whole narrative and expectation. And so tell me what was in your mind. Because you're driven. And clearly what you set your mind to, you go get.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So do you want to know like the journey leading up to?
Yeah, both. Because the leading up to, because that sets the scene of you want to do this, you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. And then during that time at King's, how you made the most of the opportunity, because it's an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will, there's some parts I won't go into much detail.
Sure.
Others I will. Growing up, I mentioned I was always academic, so that for me wasn't necessarily ever a problem. And so I think that gave me the belief, even when I guess I wasn't getting the encouragement from the systems I was a part of, the education system or whatever other systems I was kind of a part of. But at home, people would call me doctor. There were teachers that would call me doctor from really young. And so I always had that inner belief, arrogance maybe, I'm okay with that, that I could be a doctor and I wanted to be a doctor, even if I couldn't always see it as like, these are the steps. So as I got older, it became a more of a realistic sort of ambition because of the grades I was getting and because of the programs I could apply for, one of them being Amos Bursary, which was pivotal.
Amos Bursary, what's that?
Yeah, so the Amos Bursary is a charity for academically able, at the time I applied, it was academically able African and Caribbean boys. Now it's boys and girls in London and in Midlands.
Okay.
And it's a program that takes you on a journey of personal, professional and academic development to allow you to kind of achieve the goals that you want, but also serve in the best way through the places that you kind of end up in, whether that's medicine, law, the creative space, etc. And that was really pivotal for me because it gave me a community of other young Black boys who were ambitious, who came from similar areas to me. And so when I spoke about wanting to be a doctor, it wasn't out of place. It was like, oh yeah, okay, same. I want to be a doctor too.
Awesome.
And then being able to get mentors. One was a consultant. The other was a medical student. I was able to get international experience. I went to Gambia for 3 months, 3 or 4 months. I was doing stuff with the Medical Research Council. This was before I even got to medical school.
Wow.
And so having those experiences, being able to talk to those sorts of people just gave me so much confidence in my ability to go to medical school and thrive there. In my gap year, which is where I went to Gambia, I also recognized and I became a lot more cognizant of the systemic challenges that Caribbean boys and just ethnic minorities in general. I don't like to use the phrase like minorities, but I'll use it for clarity and brevity, faced in higher education. And so I was determined to sort of change some of those statistics. But more than that, I recognized early that BME as a like umbrella term wasn't useful because it didn't tell you the nuances in each group and how to kind of tailor interventions to make sure that they worked. And I think being from a Caribbean background, I recognized a lot of interventions, one, didn't work for me and my community, but two, other groups made like the numbers look better. So if you grouped everyone in BME, then the fact that Caribbean boys weren't performing well didn't matter because other groups were kind of dragging them up.
Mm.
And so for me, it was really important to separate them and make sure everyone got the intervention that they needed. And so to answer the second part of your question, that's how when I went to King's with that gap year, I made sure I was part of all the outreach initiatives. I was very kind of like involved in the department. I was making sure that I was visible on the open days. I was talking to students. I was doing programs. And then as I progressed throughout King's, it went from the programmatic work to actually like leading programs and doing events.
What do you mean programs? What do you mean by programs?
So if it was like summer schools, if it was like conferences, ad hoc, like, welcome events for students who from underrepresented backgrounds. I would kind of involve myself in all of those things. I became an intern in the department. I then was the first Black student lead within the department where I was responsible for creating a program for African and Caribbean students from low income backgrounds. That's a program that still exists and kind of continues in King's in a slightly different way, but the program exists. I then help with strategy And so there were specific targets for African and Caribbean students from low-income backgrounds in the strategy at King's, and so many other things around that.
So just on this, there's so much you said there that I'm kind of going unpick this. So I understand that you've always believed that you belong. But was the system, was the environment within, and I went to King's for my first degree, so I understand what King's has in terms of value, but did you have to knock on any doors or break down any? So what kinds of things did you have to do to overcome? What did you have to overcome?
So the way I think generally is quite systematic. And so I recognized that at first I had to kind of get in the door. And that for me was, as I mentioned, like doing the events, building goodwill. So, hey, this is the guy that comes, he turns up on time, he does the event, he's very good with students, etc. Then it was about creating events. And so, hey, can I do this? I've been a part of WP for so long. I'm really interested in this group. Can I help to create something? Then it was the internship. Then it was thinking about strategy. And so I always knew that I had to kind of build something. It's a biblical kind of phrase, but I think people use it generally as well, is that you have to, people have to trust you with a small amount in order to then trust you with kind of the bigger things. And so I recognized that early on, and I was trusted with small things, and then I think eventually over time trusted with the bigger kind of initiatives and creating things from scratch. In terms of knocking down doors, I am a person who believes in asking for forgiveness rather than permission. And so for me, it wasn't really a problem. I didn't feel as if I couldn't ask for the things I kind of needed. And if someone said no, I would just ask someone else or do it in a slightly different way. But for me, the people that needed serving were all I was focused on. I wasn't focused on how people might perceive this or if anyone would let me do it or how could I possibly do this. It was like, people need serving. How can we serve them? And so in looking back now, to now know so many students who got into medicine because of an intervention that I created or because of mentoring that I did, or someone the other day said how much I impacted the direction, not necessarily like the scale, because I never take credit for the success people have, but even putting an idea in someone's head like, hey, do you know that you can be really good at this? Have you thought about that? And kind of like planting some seeds and helping with the initial stages and allowing people to flourish. Hearing a lot of testimonials as of recently, because I think lots of people are kind of getting to that point in their lives, has reminded me like how important it was to like continue. And even when you couldn't really see what the end looked like, just keep on going. And now in this stage of my life, where I'm thinking about like bigger goals or different goals, I'm now encouraged to keep on going even when I can't see the end.
Well, some of the things, the strands that I am picking up that I can, again, playing our tapes, I think there's some similarities, although you're way ahead of the game than me. In the voluntary world, or where you want to make a difference, I think something that I try to do, I've experienced, but you certainly have, is if you see a need and you feel you can have a voice, firstly, you've got to serve the time to be able to have that voice and be willing to do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Because well, the reason,
whatever,
you know what I mean? within the boundaries, right? But it's about serving. Your reason, your purpose is that. And that then deals with all of that, but it's going to take this much effort.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to make these choices because you just do. And it doesn't feel like a sacrifice or anything like that, because it's, you're getting joy out of this because you feel like you're making a difference. And it takes time. And eventually, hopefully you keep doing the right things and people notice and you make a difference, then people will actually go, okay, maybe we'll listen to them a bit more.
Yeah. But also being okay with doing work over and over and over again and people not recognizing the value. But knowing that because you're doing that work, someone else is inspired to take on that baton, and then they will be the one to kind of open a door. I think in the work I do, even though I've had a lot of success in terms of like opening doors and like having conversations with people I need to, I'm also, and I came to this a few years ago, I'm also okay with the fact that there are some things I may never see the result of, and being okay with that. Because I think when I was younger, I was so set on, I have to be the person that makes this thing happen. And recognizing that there are so many people better than me, smarter than me, with better access, with more money, etc. I haven't been able to realize some of the things that he wanted to kind of do and see. But they enabled other people to then pick up that baton and create that change. So I'm okay with that.
It shouts volumes of your, and I'll say it, your humility and your real purpose of serving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a lot, especially in the world that we're faced with, where unless you have that, you can get very sucked into behaviors that you probably in reflection wouldn't feel that you'd want to be in that.
Yeah.
Be that. But also to be true to your, what are you trying to do? And mm-hmm. and the acceptance that whatever you do, you're in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can, if even one small element of that inspires somebody else mm-hmm. to be part of that journey,
mm-hmm.
then that's for the greater good and where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and let go of it from that sense.
Yeah.
And I can think of somebody who did this for me at Warwick. I'd been through a really bouncy, I did my MBA.
Yeah.
And great study, but I got involved in a business venture. I got an entrepreneurial one
mm-hmm.
where I had challenge after challenge
mm-hmm.
and somehow managed to get through that roller coaster and learn a mm-hmm. lot.
Yeah.
And then I remember an email popping up. I'd finished my MBA and an email popping up saying pilot mentoring program. And some very senior people who had no need to do this said, you know what? We want to be able to mentor people who are going through that journey.
Mm-hmm.
Would the benefit be we get the joy of helping them
mm-hmm.
navigate it
mm-hmm.
differently. Their choices, we hold up the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately, along with, I think, 30 other people went, yep. And that was the start of a journey that has given me immense joy.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what when I thought, okay, I'm a bit out there. Why were you involved? Because of, hey, this joy. I realized, I put my damn ego aside, when you say that and you out there in an audience of really smart people,
yep.
you put away the labels and why are you here? Because of those same human values, that mm-hmm. there's a joy in serving. And if you can help others navigate their journey, don't mm-hmm. impose your thoughts on them,
mm-hmm.
but let them make their choices. But that is such a cathartic way of getting through any pains that you've had as well. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest about it. But also the joy of seeing something grow.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows where it will go. But that's, you know, that's now grown from a small program to a global mentoring program to now a global alumni community.
Wow.
But based on people like yourself
mm-hmm.
who can see the joy of being. No monetary equation here.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there's a need here. And if I've got a voice, while I've got a voice, while mm-hmm. people are listening,
mm-hmm.
let's put that out there and let the rest take over that baton mm-hmm. when it happens. So that's incredible. So you went through that journey.
Mm-hmm.
You've given us an insight into how you were heard.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the end of med school.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened? Because you said you're not a practice. You didn't go and take up medicine.
Yeah.
What changed in that journey?
So throughout medical school, as I progressed through it, I became less and less excited about the prospect of practicing. But at no point before final year did I think about not practicing at all. I always thought I would practice less and less. So I started thinking I was going to have a full career in medicine. That's what I was going to do. Then partway through, it was, I'm going to finish, specialize, and then maybe step away. Then it was, I might do foundation training, get my kind of full registration, then step away. And then the final year was when my friend was kind of reaching the, she was going to pass away during that year. And I wasn't necessarily not going to practice because of that. But I think as I thought more and more about what I wanted to do, I spoke to a lot of people during my final year as well. I also have to caveat and say that throughout medical school, I did a lot of internships. So Google, I worked at Aviva, I worked at KPMG in the US. I spent some time doing some work with them too. So there were lots of things I did outside of medicine.
Doing what? How? Okay. Again, yeah. for simple people like me.
Yeah.
I go to medical school.
Yeah.
And my idea of it, what I do is go and do some help in a hospital in a something in the something. But you're going to work at all these amazing places as an intern.
Yeah.
What were you telling them? What got you there?
I was telling them the truth. I had skills that are transferable. Skills that allowed me to work under pressure, to manage lots of information, analyze it, come up with a solution. I could work in teams. I could communicate effectively. All those things doctors can do. And I think I recognized that earlier than I think a lot of medical students do. I think more and more are actually recognizing it now and realizing their skills are transferable. But for me, I recognized because I was in Amos Bursary, because I was doing internships, because I had so many people around me that were entrepreneurial in their thinking, in that they saw problems and wanted to solve them in unconventional ways, or they didn't limit themselves into a box, I could also then kind of adopt some of those behaviors. And so by the time I got to the end of medical school, I recognized that practicing was my only option. And so I could have conversations to explore what other options could look like, but also still having the humility to say that if at the end of this, I arrive at the answer, which is to practice, I would practice. There wasn't like, oh, because I can do other things, I'm not going to practice. I'm going to show them that I am better. No, I just wanted to arrive at like full information and make a decision that made sense for me. And so I still applied to practice. I got an offer to practice in a good training program, like a really good one. And I also had other offers from like big tech and like corporate offers, etc. And so when I got to the end, I just thought, I don't want to practice. Like, that isn't what I want to do in my core. There are other ways to kind of fulfill the mission that don't include clinical practice. So I rejected the offer to practice. And then spent the year, I always say scratching some itches. It doesn't sound the greatest, but I'd never been involved in like health policy, for example. I'd never done things around health tech and innovation specifically. And so I spent the year kind of engaging in those things through the Y20, which is the youth arm of the G20, and also through an innovation fellowship. And then I worked for a startup.
Again, this evolving mind who isn't locked in any sort of cage, who is a free spirit, who is living, as opposed to I'm on the conveyor belt and I've got to keep going down this path, which the majority of us find ourselves on. You casually mentioned, and I sort of went to the Y20 and I got involved in some innovation. So take somebody back. Say I'm sitting here. I'm a med school final year guy or whatever I'm studying. And I'm thinking, okay, where does somebody start to even look for opportunities? Because you have this ability to see. And you've kind of explained part of it, I guess, is because of the people that would be mentoring you in that environment. But where does somebody start? If somebody is going, okay, I want to take this as a way of taking my journey forward, where would they start for exploring innovation or exploring policy and being involved in that?
So I think for me, something I did throughout medical school was I went to all the events. I went to law events. I went to consulting, investment banking. I went to arts, creative events. I went to all of them because I didn't like limit my ability to learn and meet new people to medicine and healthcare. I thought you can learn from lots of people. You can get free food in all these events as well.
Always useful as a student.
And so I was more than happy to go and meet new people. And so I think that's the first thing. Just be curious. Go to events, meet new people, hear new perspectives. And don't limit yourself to just being around like healthcare and other doctors or other medical students. Even within sort of healthcare, meet other healthcare professionals, see what they're doing, see how they learn, and be open to sort of going and meeting people in real life. Like go to in-person events. That's I think the first thing that people don't do as often anymore. Don't go in person to meet real people. I think secondly, LinkedIn is a great resource. Go on there. Search doctors, see what they're doing. What companies have they been at? What roles do they have? Search some of the roles. Go on some of the company websites. See like things that might interest you. And then I think something that's really useful as well is to look at job descriptions. What kind of experience are they looking for? What kind of things are they asking off that job role and then try and reverse engineer that. How do I get that experience? How do I demonstrate those skills? What can I do in junior medical school that I think would be really useful for a job like this or for a company like that? Or also speak to people that work there. Reach out on LinkedIn, see if they have any public events, which most companies kind of do, particularly for students. They always have events. Figure out what the culture's like, what kind of work you do. Are there any projects that you can start whilst in medical school? Can you learn to code? That's a kind of a clickbaity one that people would say, yeah. I want to learn to code. But that's a skill, right? There's so many things that you can kind of do now on YouTube, on all these websites for free, that I think we live in a perfect time to expand your horizon and really choose what you want to do, particularly if you have a privilege of being at medical school.
Okay, yeah. So medical school and transferable skills, mm-hmm. and getting relevant experience.
Yep.
But you've managed to get yourself as the UK delegate,
mm-hmm.
for the Y20.
Yeah, health, well-being and sport.
Health, well-being and sport. Mm-hmm. Experience-wise,
yep.
What were you presenting? I mean, you have to tell me what your application was, but yep. what was your story? Because mm-hmm. it's clearly compelling.
Yeah.
And they made a great choice. Yeah. But what is it that you put out there?
I think from what I remember, again, it was just transferable skills. How have the things I've done in medicine, how did they allow me to be a good delegate, a communicator of policy, being able to synthesize lots of information? Those are all useful and so very applicable. I think alongside that, I was able to demonstrate a real passion and understanding why policy is important as a lever for change. I realized that not too long before I applied, if I'm completely honest. But when I did, it was really important for me to seek out opportunities to engage in policy at local and international level. And so when this opportunity arose, I applied and I took it.
You took it. Incredible. Yeah. Incredible. And that allowed you to do what? I don't want to talk too long on this Y20. Yeah. But what did that allow you to do, being part of a UK delegate for Y20?
So what was really good is then I was exposed to sort of other multilateral organisations. I engaged with Commonwealth, engaged with Chatham House. And so that was really useful to kind of be aware and be engaged with those institutions. I went to India first time, and I was able to meet delegates from all over the world. People who are now my friends, who I speak to, I wouldn't say frequently, but regularly. And I'm able to sort of have a home somewhere else in the world, which is amazing. I was able to learn from different contexts, things that I take for granted here or things they might take for granted. We're able to exchange ideas and figure out how our context then shape some of the policy recommendations that we were contributing to this discussion. And so, yeah, it was a great experience, able to engage with students in the UK as well. I met you at Warwick because there was an engagement there. Also went to UCL, met students through other forums in London. That it was an incredible experience to kind of hear some of the thoughts that young people had on their sort of health and policies that should be implemented. And then more than anything, it gave me a sort of like a skeleton to then build on to think about policy in the future. And then even going to Harvard, which I'll talk about.
Yeah, so that takes us beautifully onto the Harvard story, because I think I after we met on this panel, mm-hmm. said we need to meet up.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember speaking to you here in London,
mm-hmm.
and then you dropped on me, "Oh yeah, I'm going to Harvard." You said, "Huh?"
Yeah, I think I was applying when I spoke to you.
I think with you,
yeah.
applying to me means you're going to Harvard.
You're going.
So tell me about that. What was that about, and how did you? What were you trying to get out of it? And what?
So for me, because I didn't practice, it was important for me to specialize. And I also recognized that the reason I went into medicine in the first place was because I cared about the social determinants of health. I said earlier that I recognized that if I didn't have a car, if I couldn't get to hospital, which was an hour away, if we didn't have the money, if we couldn't advocate for ourselves, all these things, I probably wouldn't have made it. And so reflecting on that and being able to articulate that, I then thought, public health is actually what I really care about. being able to influence all the things that affect our healthcare on a community level. Influence strategy, influence policy, influence all the sort of macro things that then affect how you interact on an individual level. And so I looked at all the public health schools. I spoke to a lot of people, again, that had kind of followed a similar journey. And then I applied to, I only applied to two schools, one in the UK and then Harvard. And ultimately chose to go to Harvard because I thought that was the best place for me to sort of learn, to meet people from across the world, and to shape myself as a public health leader and strategist.
Again, it flows.
Yeah.
For me, the journey flows.
Yep.
Where you can make a bigger impact based on your insights,
mm-hmm.
and your learning and your connection and building and understanding. So, okay, so you go to Harvard. I noticed a post you did recently.
Yep.
You're giving back to people who are going to be taking on, from your experience,
mm-hmm.
other people who are going to be going potentially to Harvard or yep. wherever else, how to make the most of it
yep.
based on what worked for you and what you wish you'd done.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to share some of those. You don't have to,
yeah,
but go for it.
I first want to reflect on the experience a little bit.
Go for it.
To then inform kind of how I think to make the most of it. The experience was phenomenal for me. It really resonated with the type of person I am in terms of I have a lot of interests, and I believe that the solutions I want to create in the world are nuanced and require sort of different inputs. And so studying at American University allows you to choose courses from different disciplines. But studying at Harvard means you can choose courses from all the graduate schools, even the college. And there are 12 graduate schools, I think. So education school, the government school, the business school. I was at the public health school. There is the engineering school. There's so many schools that I haven't even kind of mentioned. Then you also have MIT that you can take classes at as well. And so being able to do all of that and learn from so many different people who are like at the forefront of their field, which for me was incredible. But more than anything, you were taught to be able to like apply it to life and to the work that you're going to do. And for me, it was the first time the onus wasn't on necessarily like getting the best grades or handing in the best assignment. It was the people who could apply it best to like real life situations and real life problems in the world. And so the advice for people going in, I think the first one is to stay curious. There's so much that Harvard offers you, and you can miss out on opportunities if you're not kind of curious about them. I think with that, it's planning, because there is so much, you have to make sure that you try and be as aware as possible of what is at your disposal. The caveat to that is that because there is so much, you can't access it all. And so that's why it's so important to sit down and be really deliberate in these are the things that I know I like, and these are the things I'm going to try. And not trying to overextend yourself, because there are thousands of opportunities at Harvard. Every day there are multiple things that you could be doing. And if you try and engage in them all, you will burn out. I think the second thing, because that for me was that one point, second thing is that everyone who goes there has to prioritize relationship building. Because what makes any experience, I think, not just Harvard, is the people. But Harvard particularly, there are people from all over the world. From every corner of the world I can think of, there are sort of students from there. And I think it was engaging with those students that really made my experience what it was, and really kind of allowed me to widen my perspective on the solutions that I could create in the world, and really inspired me, actually. And lastly, have fun. Have fun. Don't take it like too seriously. I don't take life like too seriously. I take it seriously enough.
Seriously enough. I like that.
And then the rest of it is fine.
That's a great insight,
mm-hmm.
for someone like me,
mm-hmm.
Who has no understanding or exposure to American education system. Yeah. In my journey, I don't learn well from repetitive.
Yeah.
Here's a theory, go learn it, go churn it out. I very much am a practical learner.
Mm-hmm.
And so any opportunity I get was working with, you know, for 10 years I've managed to deliver courses externally and work with teams.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all practical.
Yeah.
I always put it down to the theory is really easy.
Mm-hmm.
And in this modern day of information, everything's accessible, mm-hmm. right? But having people meet as people, again, joined up to this for me is about the people that you're interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
Add to the richness of the experience and the understanding and the learning. And being free. I love that. You're talking about Harvard and you're going, don't worry about the marks. It's about the learning. I'm not saying it.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Totally. But it's more about getting that practical learning. And that's what they're looking at and tuning into.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, you take whatever you learn in a from academic sense, but you have to be able to go and apply it in the real world. And that's what you're saying.
Absolutely.
And lastly, have fun. Well, I think, you know, living with a constant inquisitive mindset like yours, living in a way of serving, spirit of serving. So your day, your faith is strong there. It's a service to the Lord. But then through whatever he's given you, serving with everything that he's given you, serving society and making a difference.
Yep.
So you've taken that away from Harvard.
Yep.
And you're back here again.
Yep.
But you're not back here.
Stay tuned.
Okay.
That's my answer to that.
I love it. James, now we've come to, I guess, where you are in the journey now.
Mm-hmm.
What's the vision? What is this all about?
Yeah. So over the last few years, I have been developing my capacity to serve. So I've been, this is why I went to Harvard, this is why I've done all the experiences that I've engaged in, because I want to be the best servant for the community I care about. And so now I believe I'm approaching a place where I can now really realize that mission, right, that you're asking about. And for me, that looks like a fully integrated society that is centered around improving people's health. For me, I kind of spoke about a lot of the barriers I faced, all right? More than that, it's how do you design a system that cares for people closest to where they feel most comfortable, whether that's where you live, whether that's where you work, the barbershop, where you meet your friends, it can be anywhere. And so I don't want a world that exists now where someone is trying to enter a system and can't, because the system doesn't cater for them, it doesn't speak the same language as them, it doesn't recognize the pain in the way they recognize it, or even the remedies in the way they recognize it. And so it's getting it closer, so the system does this. Ultimately, however, I've always wanted to return back to Jamaica and improve the provision of healthcare there. I believe that is a country that made me who I am today. It's a country that saved my life. It's a country that instilled so many values that I still hold dear to me. And so for me, the dream would be able to give back ultimately to the country that made me. So that's the mission. That's the big hairy goal. But I think ultimately it's always trying to be in touch with the purpose that God has for me. And if he says, go to Timbuktu, that's where I go.
I hear that loud and clear. Every pore in your body, every glint in your eye and that smile tells me that you are absolutely tuned into achieving that mission. It's something that is close to my heart in terms of changing the world and society. And wherever you choose to do it, wherever you find yourself, your heart's always going to take you back to Jamaica, and you're always going to be making a difference, bringing everything from around the world, I believe, back to Jamaica and giving back to the land that made you and transforming lives. And ultimately, you're on a journey of transforming lives. And in my little way, I'm hoping to share those journeys like yours to make a little difference in the world.
Amen.
Congratulations. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.